Many people will be familiar with the big screen persona of Ian Fleming's James Bond, as portrayed by Sean Connery, George Lazenby, Roger Moore, Timothy Dalton, Pierce Brosnan, and now Daniel Craig. They might also be aware of alternative performances by David Niven in a 1967 version of Casino Royale, and even Barry Nelson in the TV adaptation of Casino Royale in 1954. Far less attention has been paid to radio play adaptations of Fleming's novels, which appeared as early as 1955, when an adaptation of Moonraker was broadcast on South African radio, and starring Blockbuster's host Bob Holness as 007. In this podcast, we focus on a series of BBC radio plays based on Fleming's work and starring Toby Stevens as James Bond that were broadcast from 2008 up until 2020. Each of them is 90 minutes long, they have a recurring cast and crew, and function as an alternative to the more famous movie adaptations. To talk about these plays, I'm joined by journalist and Bond aficionado Lee Kenny. Lee is joining me from New Zealand, and so the sound quality will reflect that.
So Lee, what were your first impressions of listening to these radio plays?
I really enjoyed them, James. And I was trying to think how much I knew about them before you suggested we kind of did this as a topic. I definitely remember that they'd been recorded well over 10 years ago, but hadn't listened to any of them. And so this was a really nice excuse to actually have to, you know, to go back through and to play them. It's hard to know whether they're good examples of radio play or whether they are just enjoyable for a Bond fan to be able to kind of go back through and, you know, enjoy the stories, you know, in a slightly different format. But yeah, for the most, I really did enjoy them. There are things I enjoyed a lot about, which perhaps we can talk about in a bit more detail. Some stuff I didn't feel worked quite so well. But overall, I thought the standard was very high. And I'm interested to know your thoughts, actually. What did you think?
Yeah, I thought they were excellent. I mean, I think what I liked a lot about them, I think just specifically from the Bond perspective, was the fact that they kind of bring out the kind of dreaminess and the kind of weirdness, the oddness of Ian Fleming's work. You get a lot of that in the early part, in the early films from like 62 to 89 before Pierce Brosnan, where you get really odd elements that are there in the films that they can't ignore because they've taken them straight from Fleming's work. But obviously they're toned down with all, you know, comedy or trying to make an kind of action thriller and all the other things that we associate with Bond, especially in the early years. But because these are specifically from Fleming, all that comes through, the kind of oddness of it, the weird detail. Fleming's stuff goes from being quite realistic. Then he'll have Bond fighting a giant squid, do you know? Even the films haven't touched. Do you know? You know, that's too silly even for the films. So I like that element.
Yeah, and definitely, and what you get here that you definitely don't get in the films, and to some extent the books don't give you much of an insight into, is you get like Bond's like inner monologue, which is quite unique. And so unique to the extent that at first I wasn't entirely sure whether he was actually saying this stuff out loud. And I was like, come on, James, you can do this. And at first I thought, oh, he's kind of, you know, he's a private moment. He's kind of, I don't know what he's trying to do, kind of goad himself in some kind of situation. But then it went on for so long that I thought, oh, okay, fair enough. This must just be his internal monologue that we're hearing. But you're so unused to hearing that it kind of took me by surprise. That was definitely a good use of the format. But then you also got, which is kind of slightly strange, I got used to it, but I wouldn't say I liked it, was that you also had like a kind of semi-narration from an actor playing Ian Fleming. So you've got both the story, you've got the dialogue, you've got the inner monologue, and you've also got the narration, which is quite a lot of devices at play. I don't think it was to the detriment of it, but that was quite interesting that they would use all of those storytelling devices. Often, you know, within the space of a few minutes.
Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. So sometimes you've got quite big action sequences where it's just the sound of gunfire going off and hearing what Bond's saying. And other times they blend in the Martin Jarvis, I think he's the director of the plays, he plays Fleming, reading from the book. I think sometimes it's quite intuitive and I quite liked it. And I think where mixed, there's always a kind of strange kind of music that supports some of the sequences, like this kind of weird kind of soundscape almost. I think it plays into that idea of the kind of dreaminess of it. There's a general weirdness to these plays, which I think is appropriate for the books. I like what you said about Bond's inner monologue. Sometimes it works really well. And I think there's a moment in the adaptation of Diamonds Are Forever where he's in the casino and it's just excellent, you know, when he's talking through how he's playing the game. And then there's the other moment when he gets attacked by the centipede in Dr. No. And he's like, he's describing this like centipede crawling up his naked body. I mean, it's adapted in the book and it's virtually impossible to pull off well. It comes across as a little bit silly. Not that there's anything wrong with the way that they do it, the best that it can be done.
Definitely,
but it's not.
Yeah, moment where the deadly centipede is crawling up his foot, his leg, across his chest, across his face. It's quite evocative, you know. But probably would have lent itself well to actually like switching back to like narration mode. There's like a deep level of self reflection taking place at a time when really you probably wouldn't even be aware of thinking anything. But it's interesting you said about the details. That was one of the notes I made, is that it was really good to hear Fleming's dialogue and also the level of detail that he includes within stories. And it was really nice to be reminded, actually, how well he writes dialogue and how well he writes detail.
Which you completely forget about when you're not hearing it. You know, not that much of Fleming's dialogue comes across in the films. But I think it really kind of comes alive here. And part of that is because of the cast. And we'll talk about Toby Stevens in a minute because the way he plays Bond. But I was reading through, looking at the people who'd been in this, I think there's 9 plays. Mm. You've got like Mark Gatiss, Tim Pigott-Smith, Peter Capaldi, Tom Hollander, Alistair McGann, Rosamund Pike, Alfred Molina, Tom Conti, John Sessions, Joanna Lumley, David Suchet. Obviously, I'm reading them off a list. Nigel Havers, Stacey Keach, and like Jared Harris. I mean, all these people who are like, these are massive name actors.
Yeah, yeah. So, and some of those are playing like pivotal roles, like the villains. Some of them are playing like bit parts you wouldn't even know. They're clearly just there because what I got from it actually was a real sense of actually fun. And there's, you know, the fact that they've now done 9 with the same director, the same actors, lots of the same cast. Obviously, everybody's well up for it. And the fact that you can just kind of get, you know, fair enough. If you know, you say to David Suchet, you know, it's 100 years since the birth of Ian Fleming. Would you come and play Dr. No? That's quite prestigious. But if you're saying to Nigel Havers, would you come in and read a few lines for us? They're obviously up for it. So, so lots of those actors you mentioned there, like well-known people, but they're not playing recognizable, well-known characters from the James Bond world. Obviously, you know, sometimes unrecognizable because they're playing, they're using funny accents and the like that you wouldn't even know was them.
Absolutely. I think like Capaldi comes on and plays Q, I think, and he's in it for like one scene. Was it worth him, you know, it's worth him getting the taxi over to the studio, I suppose. But some of this...
One scene, and he manages to say girl's gone twice, doesn't he? like Fleming's really trying to hammer home that point.
He plays Q in the scene where Bond has his Beretta switched for the PPK. It's like a famous scene, isn't it? From the novel Dr. No and in the film as well.
Yeah, I think at that point he's still the armourer. He's referred to as Q.
Absolutely correct. He becomes the Q character in the films later on.
In terms of like standouts, like you mentioned, like Tim Pigott-Smith, things like that. I mean, absolutely amazing as Kerim Bey, like real standout. Like he's everything you'd want. He's Darko Kerim, isn't he, in the book, but Kerim Bey in the films. But absolutely sensational performance.
Tim Pigott-Smith in
he's in Quantum of Solace. I mean, it's interesting because quite a lot of these people that they must have had like a brush with the Bond franchise themselves. Like it's not impossible to think that like Alfred Molina at some point or Jared Harris at some point, you know, their names must have come up. Nigel Havers, they must have only been one step away from the films themselves. I would have thought. Do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, for a start, I mean, Ian Ogilvy is another one who played the same. He turns up. I think he's got a couple of lines in, or a few lines in Moonraker. But obviously, Tim Pigott-Smith, he's in Quantum of Solace, so he's got a bit part in Quantum of Solace. Joanna Lumley is in one of them, and obviously Rosamund Pike, the two main ones, with Rosamund Pike turning up and Toby Stevens playing Bond. Obviously, both of those were in Die Another Day, playing the villains. So that's a bit of a change there. What did you think of Toby Stevens? I always thought he would have been a good James Bond anyway, regardless. I think, you know, he had the right voice and the right look for it when he was younger. And I think he's excellent in this.
Yeah, and it's one of the kind of the sort of the thoughts I've had as a result of listening to his performance is actually to kind of go back and think about Die Another Day. And released in 2002. I mean, for all its faults, there's a lot of good in there. But sadly, you know, it's almost a kind of like wasted, almost like it's like a wasted part for him playing, you know, the kind of Gustav Graves. Almost, what he even says, doesn't he? Like, he models himself on James Bond. Like, I was only in your presence. It's been a long time since I saw it. But, you know, when he created the character of Gustav Graves, he modeled him on Bond. And, so obviously, yeah, so it's not, it was never impossible to imagine him playing Bond. So good that he's getting the chance to do it. And does it well. Yeah, does it. Yeah, you're right. Like, yeah, the voice is good. Obviously, he's playing a period Bond. Like, so these are all obviously kind of set in the 50s or maybe early 60s. You know, on the strength of this, actually, yeah, it's very good, very, very consistent. And they've done these over the course, done these over 12 years now, I think. 2008 was the first one, then they, you know, did one earlier this year. So, you know, he's obviously very keen on doing. I think the consistency that he brings, well, you know, he's now strangely the definitive radio voice of James Bond, isn't he?
But he's probably played James Bond. He's played James Bond more than anyone else.
There you go. But I think the consistency with his portrayal of Bond, but also like I think like Sir John Standing playing M. across all of them. And so, yes, so it's nice to hear the same voices, you know, the same actors coming, you know, coming up again. It just, you know, it just helps to build a world with a bit more substance than even the films. You know, the films are guilty of obviously chopping and changing actors.
What I like most about him is he brings that amused detachment that Bond has to a lot of scenarios. Mm. You know, he can be angry when he's wild, but a lot of the time he's playing it as if he's enjoying himself, you know. Not with a particular light touch or being flippant necessary, but that kind of sense of amusement that Bond has when he encounters a particular situation or a new environment, which I really liked. I also liked the way that Felix Leiter is portrayed in these as well. Again, I think this is the best version of Felix that exists in other than in the novel form. You know, I think that the Texan accent and there's a really good sense of the friendship that you get between them, which you really need in something like Live and Let Die, because obviously Leiter gets eaten by a shark in that one and Bond has to get his revenge. Mm-hmm. Obviously that played out in the film of License to Kill.
Yeah, definitely. I really enjoyed his performance as well. And you're absolutely right. Like if these are two actors that have worked together over the space of, you know, 10 or 12 years, but Felix Leiter, as the character not appearing in every one of them, you might be kind of absent from two or three in a row and then returns. There's a genuine warmth there and Light is good. Bond needs him. Bond relies on his help very, very strong performance from him as well.
In the films, Felix, it always feels like a little bit more like a spare part, I think, because they want to concentrate on Bond. Whereas, as you say, Fleming brings him in, he's not in there in every novel. He's there when he's needed to be there for the story.
Yeah.
Because these are based on Fleming. He's got a far more significant presence than Felix tends to have in the films.
I mean, they're 90 minutes long as well. I think that's another thing that really works in their favour. But they have adapted, you know, for example, from Rush with Love to bring Bond into the story early on and things like that. So, yeah, not afraid to rework Fleming's stuff, but still very faithful to it.
Some of the most interesting bits that I found were where they tried to introduce elements that we've seen in the films. Like in each one has this kind of strange pre-credits sequence or pre-type sequence, but usually done in a kind of like a quite an abstract or based around the theme. Like you'll often get villains. I think in Live and Let Die, it's the reading of the tarot cards before the title turns up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's really, really effective. So you've got this kind of hangover from James Bond films as well, where the pre-title sequence is Bond, one of the conventions. Again, it sets the mood, it sets that kind of the atmosphere of Ian Fleming. One thing I get from the books is there's an atmosphere more than anything else. You don't, you know, you're just hanging around in the world and his descriptions is what's exciting about these books. rather than them being page-turning thrillers. I think it's more about the atmosphere hanging around. And that's one thing that these plays really, really brought to life, I thought.
Yeah, I agree. The other thing, I'd said how much I enjoyed hearing Fleming's detail and dialogue, but the other thing it kind of brought to the fore was how Fleming's not always great with plot. And not only do you get the best of Fleming in these, but you also get, you do get the most, you get the silliest, the most absurd as well.
Absolutely. And I think that's, but that's what, it's one thing, isn't it? I don't know whether we've probably talked about this before privately. You can't make the statement, I like Fleming apart from these bits. It's like, you have to like those bits. You have to accept the fact that, look, it just go, it's just really ridiculous at times, silly or even indefensible from all sorts of reasons. But you kind of have to take that, the rough with the smooth, to get the full experience. I mean, some of it's really, as you said about the plotting, I don't know if you have any other examples, but again, like Dr. No, you know, Dr. No didn't even know that he's about to be killed by James Bond. Like, so many weird details. Like, he drops a load of guano on him, doesn't he? Like, a load of bird shit on him. Yes. Again, he even too silly even for the films to deal with. And I think Bond does it. He just climbs up a rigging and just drops a load of stuff on him from a crane. So he doesn't even, you know, there's not even like a satisfying revenge that.
Yeah, and he's built this this kind of sadistic obstacle course. It's just lucky for him that this secret agent comes along to put him through his paces. I mean, like, had Bond not turned up, I mean, what would he have been doing with that? Like,
when did he build that? Did he build it after Bond arrived, or was it just on anticipation that he would? Yeah.
Some of it's fine because it's you know, it's ridiculous spectacle plotting. It's been a long time since I saw Thunderball, but I think it's consistent with the film as well. Just so happens that Bond gets like sent to a health farm at the same time, at the same place as the pilot that's about to go and steal the NATO fighter jet that's carrying the two atomic bombs. That which kind of just such a shame that like the adventure starts off in such a silly way. Bond would have been assigned to that anyway. It just doesn't make any sense, and it's just so unnecessary.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. All he had to do was write in that a man with a strange tattoo has checked into Shrublands. So we're sending you to Shrublands to investigate.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Rather than he just happens to be sent to Shrublands to where this Spectre operative is.
In this, he just goes on like M's recommendation. Like, M's been there and he's got nothing but good things to say about the place. And it just won't relent until Bond says, oh, I've checked in. And
in the film of Never Say Never Again, which doesn't have the best reputation, but that seems to be even more explicit, and that it makes a little bit more sense as to why he's sent, in that Bond's done badly in these training exercises and his body's like getting too old, and he's got too many free radicals. He's having too many, you know, he's eating too much pate and drinking too many martinis. So they send him to this health bar, stumbles upon a Spectre operation. You're right. It's irritating, but it's so embedded in Fleming, this silliness, and sometimes this kind of real surrealism, and also sometimes kind of gritty reality of spy work is all blended in together in this concoction, which is it's not for everyone. And I think one thing I quite like about these plays is that they bring that out. You know, the films really kind of mitigate all that. They mock that. They kind of parody that right from the start. These radio plays, they play all that very straight. You know, they're not apologetic about that. They're not doing it in a kind of tongue-in-cheek way to take the piss out of it. They're playing it straight. They're going at it kind of full pelt. You know, they don't seem to hold back with it, which I really liked. Mm.
Fleming obviously really knows the Cold War well. He knew the Soviet Union well, and he knew the Cold War well. Then when he tries to write about the US, or if he tries to write about New York or the Mafia, it's then. And now, I don't know whether that's just because through our own popular culture stuff, we're very exposed to that. So maybe, you know, the Mafia that Fleming knew, or Las Vegas that Fleming knew, if he ever knew it, it just seems a bit outdated. But it always feels like the stuff he's doing in like writing about Turkey and writing about Russia, that stuff I think has aged far better than the stuff when he's kind of dealing with the mob and he's in Harlem and all those.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that's one of the criticisms that of his work that I've heard. The particularly the gangster characters, they seem to talk in dialogue that is really maybe outdated even by the 50s when he's writing kind of 30s style gangster movie talk. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't even by the 1950s anyone talk like that at all. I mean, everyone said he had a great ear. Yeah. A great way of describing the places that he'd been to, that journalistic edge. So I don't know. It might be we're doing him a massive disservice and all this stuff was absolutely accurate, but I suspect not. It sounds like when you read that dialogue, especially when you hear actors saying it, it does sound like they're talking movie talk rather than speaking in any form of natural way that anyone would speak. You know, the bridge game, for example, in the adaptation of Moonraker is excellent because you get this, and all the gambling scenes are excellent because that's when you see Fleming's passions come out and he knows the conversations that happen around the gaming tables. He's been in those environments and he's met those kind of people, particularly in Moonraker, when it's the great and the good are meeting to have these gambling sessions playing bridge. I don't think he met any gangsters from my knowledge of them. Certainly the way that they talk is. It is old-fashioned and it doesn't age well.
I mean, there's some great stuff in Diamonds Are Forever, especially when Felix Leiter is saying, like, you don't cross these guys. If they find out I'm investigating them, they won't just come after me. They'll burn down my sister's house with her in it. So he obviously, like, he understands, like, the threat level. But yeah, when he's naming characters, when he's writing their dialogue and the situations.
There's some good bits there. The Winton Kidd characters from Diamonds Are Forever are excellent because there's something unusual about them and they're real sadists. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a great bit in the book, which, I mean, in my opinion, Diamonds Are Forever, I don't think it's a great book, but I thought the play was one of the best ones. Mm. These ones that I listened to. And the Winton Kidd, where they pour the boiling mud over that jockey who's hasn't thrown the race. And they give Bond a beating as well. All that stuff's excellent. But there's a strange thing. I think he kind of skims over the Bond killing them as well, where he kind of jumps through the window and he's got his gun trained on him, and then it kind of fades out, so you don't really get the end. You just hear him talking about what he did. I think he made it look like a murder suicide. It's on the cruise ship. Some bits of it come alive well, and some bits they do come across as silly and contrived. But I suppose that's all part of it.
I noticed that Toby Stevens, I quite liked his reactions. Like he does a thing that you never hear Bond do in the films, where he'll say something like, some of his very small mannerisms. And I guess that's because the performance is entirely audio. There were some little kind of like demonstrations of his nervousness or his excitement or his uncertainty was portrayed. And I really like that about it.
I think there's an element, isn't there, where it's quite jarring when you first listen to it, and when you when you get into it more, it becomes more intuitive, and everything about it feels more natural, and you start to pick up nuances as to when he's talking to Honey Rider about her experiences and the way she killed that man in Revenge with the Black Widow spider, and then you go into his inner monologue, even though he's still in the same scene about how much he'd like to sleep with her and whether it would be right to sleep with her. You pick up on the nuances the more you listen to it. But I think it was Raymond Chandler in his review of Diamonds Are Forever. I'm pulling this straight from my memory. But he said he didn't like it when Bond thinks, and that Bond in Diamonds Are Forever does way too much thinking. And I think that was the biggest hurdle I had getting over these was Bond's constant thought process. As soon as I'd gone past it, I felt it was not only appropriate, I felt that was really effective technique.
Because otherwise, like, I mean, like during the fights, like during the sex scenes, like during the non-spoken scenes, his performance is great. There's one bit where he's doing press-ups. He's making a lot of noise, and then his housekeeper, May, comes in and says, "Oh, Mr. Bond, what are you doing?" And he says, "Oh, I'm just doing some press-ups." And she says, "How many have you done?" And he says, "Oh, that must be 20 by now." I was like, wish he'd stuck an extra zero on that. Like the noise he's making just didn't seem appropriate to the amount of press ups he was doing. But I like that it was in there because that was something that Fleming had Bond doing a lot. It was like he was doing his calisthenics and his press ups and all that kind of stuff. So it's straight from the source material. But
I think, in fairness, one, Fleming smoked 70 a day. Maybe doing 20 preferences a lot. Two, I think Bond's supposed to just be out of bed. And three, if I remember rightly from the novel, he does specify that he does them really slowly. So like he lowers himself down slow. Maybe I've imagined that. But he goes down slowly and goes up slowly. He's not banging them out quickly. But yeah. 20 is not a lot.
My favourite film is From Rush With Love. So it's a coincidence that my favourite play was From Rush With Love as well. But I think what made it work really well as a play, From Rush With Love, was the lack of action that's in that story. So it is quite dialogue heavy, but also like, some really nice soundscapes with the train that was like used really well when they're on the Orient Express. Yeah, the stuff when they're in Turkey works really well. So that's probably the one I enjoyed. I enjoyed them all, but that's, you know, maybe I just have a fondness for that story. And I remember that was probably one of the first of Fleming's books that I read as well. When I was about 15 or 16. So maybe it's that really. Maybe there's a bit of nostalgia there. But I thought that did work particularly well.
Yeah, one thing I think people, if they're not familiar with Fleming, that, again, the general strangeness that you get from reading Fleming, and the oddness to the stories and the inconsistencies in the plotting, but also how some books have a complete lack of action. You know, there is a formula to James Bond, and there's a formula to his novels as well, but it varies quite dramatically. Yes, you have the same scenes repeated, but there's barely any action in Casino Royale. The next novel, Live and Let Die, there's loads of action. He's doing loads of shit. You know, he's getting involved in lots of big action scenes. Moonraker, back to virtually no action again. And then Diamonds Are Forever, far more of it. To the point where you get all the way down to something like From Rush With Love, which not much action in it at all, or something like The Spy Who Loved Me, where Bond doesn't turn up to page 130 and it's not even his story. He's just just kind of wanders into someone else's story, and there's just a little bit of action at the end. One scene I really liked was in Moonraker, was the relationship between Gala Brand and James Bond. Because in the book, they don't get together, and there's this really poignant end scene where Bond asks her out, but she says, "No, I'm getting married tomorrow to this policeman," and so it's really good to see that relationship in this radio play, and to have that really poignant ending, which we've never seen dramatised before. It'd be interesting to know what someone who hadn't read Fleming brought to these plays, because there's something about listening to a radio play where the listener has to do a lot of the work, I think, and bring their kind of preconceived notions or kind of imaginations to the story. If you drift out of listening to Dr. No, you know, you can fill in the blanks, right?
And how there's the kind of like consistent inconsistencies across the Bond universe. So like you just mentioned then, James, like even across Fleming's books, there's like the different styles that he approached, and yeah, sometimes James Bond is a bit part in his own novel, and then they want to make film adaptations, and there's so many different versions of that and unofficial versions of that, and you know, they start with Dr. No, which kind of makes things awkward from the outset, because there are then some books that don't get adapted into films until decades and decades later. And then they started these radio plays in 2008 for Fleming's, the centenary year of Fleming's birth. But they don't start with Casino Royale. They start with Dr. No. So although the focus is on Fleming's work, the first radio play was also the first film that was adapted. So yeah, these weird, like, consistent inconsistencies that just I don't know. It all makes sense. But you have to be over a lot, I think, with James Bond stuff, like to get your head around what they've created. I think you have to be across a lot over a long period of time as well, because otherwise it's... None of it makes any sense how they've been adapted, or you know, and written, and now they've actually, with the plays, they've had to kind of go back and fill in the stories which occurred before, you know, From Rush With Love is the precursor from Dr. No and stuff like that. But when that was released in 2008, that wouldn't have been the case. So yeah, weird that they've kind of, that at no point has anybody sought to do things in the most logical way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, From Rush With Love, technically he dies at the end of that, right? I think because he gets poisoned and drifts into unconsciousness. And as you say, none of it makes sense the way it was adapted. I think one thing I liked about these plays was they still retained some of the non-politically correct elements of Fleming, right? They're very much aimed at adults, right? Maybe I wouldn't even say that they toned down anything. They seem to get the spirit of Fleming really well, which is that Fleming probably thought of himself as relatively progressive, right? Mm. But he mm-hmm. writes in language which we wouldn't consider to be progressive nowadays, right? Mm-hmm. So they retain mm. the spirit of that spirit of openness, but also mm. there's no getting away from some of the elements and the attitudes that you probably wouldn't get away with now if it was an original piece of work. Mm-hmm. So it was good to see them adapt mm. these things and staying true to what was originally written in the 1950s.
Well, I had a similar kind of thought about how you can adapt a radio play in a way that you can't adapt a film. And we've like talked about like Tim Pigott-Smith just being brilliant as Darko Krim by basically putting on a Middle Eastern accent in a way that would not be appropriate or acceptable if it was a screen adaptation. And I guess radio fiction and adaptations of radio face a lot less scrutiny than film or television, which is fine as far as I'm concerned, because it's all acting. I don't have a problem with it in any way, shape or form. But there are a lot of actors, you know, doing accents.
You're absolutely correct, yeah. And like Suchet's accent as Dr. No is... Well, it's unlike... I mean, you couldn't even say it was an impression of a...
No.
It's like an alien kind of...
yeah,
...over that he does. Whereas with Kerim Bey or Darko Krim, he's a warmer character, I suppose, right? He brings affection to it. So, out of all the ones you listen to, what do you think your favourite moment was from these plays? The favourite scene or your favourite elements overall?
I guess because there are so many like genuinely cinematically iconic moments in James Bond. It was always interesting to see how they dealt with the moment like Honey Rider comes out the sea and that kind of stuff, because that stuff's just so like seared into our like collective memory. So I definitely enjoyed that, like the really iconic moments that were sometimes just done in a really like subtle and almost quite a casual way, which was quite in contrast to the films. In terms of a specific moment, I've talked about how much I enjoyed From Rush With Love, and the first scene that springs to mind is actually the way that when Bond's on the Orient Express and he's being cornered by Grant. And in the film, it's one of the great fight scenes. But actually, in this, it's dealt with really quickly, really quietly. There's no long punch up. In this, he just manages to grab the knife that's hidden in the side of his attaché case and stabs him once. Dealt with very effectively, very efficiently, but in total contrast to like the kind of the more cinematic fight scene. And that works really well. I thought that was very effective.
I think for me, my favourite scene is the moment at the end of Moonraker where Garlabrand and Bond, that poignant ending where he doesn't end up with the woman, which is, as far as I know, the only time they've done a version of that that's even remotely close to that moment in the films is the end of Quantum of Solace, where Bond and Camille don't get together and they kind of go their separate ways. Lee, I really appreciate you giving up the time, and we'll do another one soon, hopefully.
My pleasure. Thanks very much, James.
Newton Talks will return.